My name is Adam Ross, and my new novel is entitled Playworld.
Set in New York City in 1980 and 81, Playworld by Adam Ross is a Bildungsroman about a child actor named Griffin who must decide if he wants to continue in this line of work. Like many coming-of-age stories, Griffin is also dealing with school, young crushes, adults behaving badly, and the many challenges that come with being a teenager. I recently spoke with Adam Ross about Playworld and how its story rhymes with his own life. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Adam Ross. So I usually ask authors to give a description of their book for our listeners, but that doesn't seem quite fair in this case because there's a lot going on in these 500 pages. Do you have an elevator speech for it, a brief description?
Actually, I do, because when you're on book tour, you have an elevator description for everything. I have an elevator description now for my life. But no, my elevator description of Playworld would be, Playworld is about a really seminal year in the life of a child actor by name of Griffin Hurt, and it takes place from 1980 to 1981. And it's really, more than anything else, about the year when he decides whether or not to continue to be an actor. I might add as a little like addendum that it's also really about a year in the life of his family. And his parents are a pair of performing artists in New York. He's got a younger brother, Orin, and it's about how some of these things that happen to both Griffin and his family transform his family during that year.
Can we talk about the meaning behind the title? Because there's a reference almost halfway through the book about the only jingle Griffin's dad ever did was for a business named Playworld.
That's right.
But Playworld seems to encompass several themes in the book, doesn't it? Like the world of acting, or the world of Dungeons and Dragons, or the barely parented New York in the 1970s and 80s when kids weren't trackable. Talk to me about the title.
Well, gosh, I mean, you did a really great job of bulleting, I think, some of the major themes, but one of the reasons, I mean, I've been obsessed with the title Playworld, gosh, for like 20 years. And in some ways, the reason that I wanted to do Playworld was because, you know, that was back when, you know, we watched so much television, but we were all watching the same television, right? We were all watching the same media. So in this crazy way, I can literally identify people of my generation by throwing out certain jingles. And I can even make it more local, because again, it was like, it was a local set of toy stores, right? So, you know, I could basically test whether or not you were a native New Yorker if I sang the jingle, which sadly, I also have memorized and will know until I'm dead. You know what I mean? It could be like the great poetry of like Philip Larkin or T.S. Eliot and the jingle for Playworld, you know what I mean? But as you said, I mean, like it also, it signals numerous themes throughout the novel. Playworld in the sense that it's about, in part, the very particular and I think lost kind of feral childhood that the latchkey generation enjoyed in the early 80s. And that the latchkey generation, the Gen Xers, subsequently corrected for when they became parents. Because I think they experienced so much danger in this actually like very formative and important time where they had the kinds of freedoms that our own children aren't allowed to have, or the Gen X adults are afraid to have. But it also signals play in the sense of role playing. I mean, Griffin's an actor. He is very adept at playing different roles. He's in a famous role as Peter Proton in this television show, but he also is, as he says in the prologue, a student of all forms of dissembling. And then, you know, I mean, I think that it also suggests play in the sense of fantasy and imagination. And that's not just about Griffin and his interest in Dungeons and Dragons, but the way in which even the narrator of this book is playing with various kinds of ideas about, you know, the city of Manhattan that no longer exists.
You said in a recent LitHub article that you wanted to write a book that rhymed with your life as a young adult. And I love that phrasing. I know you, like Griffin, were an actor. Your father, like Griffin's father, Shell, was an actor in New York. Griffin was a wrestler, and you were a regional and New York State champion wrestler. So where does Adam end and Griffin begin?
Well, so what's really important to emphasize here, and it's a question I get quite often because of those similarities, but what PlayWorld is trying to describe and is really centered on, and this is where its invention comes into play and its inventions and its artfulness is most involved. And that's this, you know, the main character of the novel, Griffin, suffers a lot of really bad things. And while I was absolutely using certain settings and experiences with which I'm familiar, and I could sit here and enumerate with you all the ways in which my life is different from Griffin's life, what I'm trying to really articulate is these moments that Griffin encounters that he doesn't have language for. And so part of the way the book operates, and I'd love to know if you felt the same way, but part of what the book's trying to do is give the reader some of these experiences, these ineffable experiences, these experiences that Griffin doesn't have language for, and really bring the reader sort of right up to the stage of, as it were, of those experiences and experience them for him or herself, and then really talk about the consequences of what it means when certain things happen to you and you don't have the language for it. And so I think that's part of what that to me is when PlayWorld is really showing what its subject is and what it's up to. And to do that, you know, you have to invent many, many things, right? You have to invent many, many experiences because that's really its territory. Its territory is, I mean, we've all had that thing happen to us when we're kids where something happens that we don't understand. And then like 10 years later as an adult, you're like, oh my God, like that's what was happening. That's what was going on. But I wanted to make that the subject of the novel, that experience per se. So when Griffin has these terrible times with his wrestling coach, or, you know, encounters these strange adults all over Manhattan, or these strange co-stars that he has on his TV show, the experience of that strangeness and the befuddlement and the confusion, I want the reader to experience as Griffin does. Because, you know, in some ways, really, the novel is about Griffin over the course of this year developing a language for his life and for these experiences. And that's really, I think, what you see unfold in the novel. You see not a complete transformation by Griffin into this, you know, hyperverbal person, but the beginnings of Griffin, you know, beginning to be able to speak to some of the things that are happening to him.
Okay, I will only ask one more thing of, was this born of your imagination, or do you have somebody like this in your life? Oren, is he based on somebody? Do you have a brother?
I have a dear and beloved younger brother, and my younger brother, he's only 22 months younger than me. And so we survived this childhood in New York City together. I mean, one of the things I love to tell is my brother and I were, you know, going cross town on the New York City buses in first grade. We were riding our bikes across town to school in third grade without helmets. And my mom would give us a dime for the payphone and would say, call me when you get to school to let me know you got there safely, right? So my brother and I, you know, went through all these things together, and we, you know, we attended public school together. You know, we were getting to and fro together all the time, right? So, yes, and my brother is the most hilarious person I know, and my brother is the most devastating truth teller I know, but he's definitely not Oren. And the proof is in the pudding in that he really loved the book. And I think that if he saw too much of himself in Oren, he would have hated the book, but he lapped it up.
You know, you were just talking about Griffin not having the language to express what was happening. And, you know, in his youth, he seemed to be a step behind in learning his lines, in his summer reading. He was getting gentleman C's. 2/3 of the way through the book, he becomes officially sick and tired of not being in the know.
That's right.
Does he successfully pivot into being in the know?
Well, I mean, I think what you see, and this is like sort of really definitely one of the intentions of the novel. I mean, I think you see hardly him developing, let's just say, some better habits so that he is quote unquote in the know. I mean, he's just getting a little bit better at not putting himself behind. It's not a spoiler to say, for instance, that, toward the end of the book, he's still really behind on his summer reading and scrambling. But I love that phrase in the know because it puns with some of the important things he begins to say at the end, which is he starts saying no to certain people. And so in other ways, it's such a great observation on your part because he is in the know in terms of throwing up what we would call boundaries now. Of course, back in 1981, no kid on the planet knew what a boundary was. And it's always hilarious to me because, oh my gosh, like my daughters are in the know about boundaries. Like, dad, I'd throw up a boundary. You know what I mean? Like, and you're like, oh my God, you're so healthy. Like that wasn't 1980 to 1981.
I don't want to give away a spoiler here, but I want to talk about memory. There was an accident of sorts, and we learn three different descriptions of that accident. And there might be more, but I can only recall Griffins, Orins, and Lilies at this point. Can you talk about the reliability of memory, and what does that do to the reliability of our narrator?
Well, I think that what I like to call the Griffin future and the Griffin in time present, right? That those narrators are reliable reporters of what they're seeing and experiencing. But I definitely think that one of Playworld's subjects is the fact that if you really start to pinch memory or get different versions of different stories, you find how really unstable even things like your own identity are, right? I mean, yes, you do. It is not a spoiler, but I mean, I think this terrible accident that happens in Griffin's early life, he's got a version of it and he finds this version continually, not only is continually deconstructed, but this version of this accident, different versions are carried around by different people and it's formed who they are, right? But there's another element, and that speaks to a certain kind of like instability, but it actually, I think, also speaks to a kind of agency that we have as we move through time and life and have to keep like retelling and retelling the story of who we are, given the new information we have in this kind of like unstable world. And there's another element here, which is really about the city of New York itself, because, Griffin, the Griffin from the future, is telling the story of a lost world. He's telling the story of a city that no longer exists. And it's a really interesting thing to think about. Like, what is the city you live in? And who are you as this person who dwelled once in the city where many of the buildings, the monuments, the sites of your childhood have been disappeared in the dynamism of a city's, changing architecture, landscape? Who are you? And what is it? It's a novel, it's a buildings room. And that means it's a novel of development. And what probably is like one of sort of the great, I don't know if I'd even call it like the messages of the book, but maybe one of the great sort of themes of the book is that movement in our lives is actually like our resting state.
I marked several passages as I read. Some were laugh out loud funny. Others gave me pause.
I'm so glad.
Sometimes this doesn't work because you might not have anything to say about these, but I'd like to read a couple to you and perhaps get your thoughts.
Sure. Cool.
Our education was spatial, racial, tribal, urban, American, but mostly, and this is the most important thing, it was dominated by Keppelman, over whom we were each failing to gain leverage, and who wore the costume of love, and who was, day in and day out, teaching us fury, aggression, complicity, desperation, exploitation, and most of all, silence.
So that is Griffin reflecting on the fact that he and his group of buddies have just done something very cruel to somebody and they don't give it a thought. I won't spoil what they do to this person, but what I was trying to think about was how when I was, again, like a feral young man, there was this way in which we would sometimes enact forms of violence or use the city and parts of the city as a kind of weapon without almost like a shred of conscience. And we weren't bad kids, but what we were experiencing was, you know, we were all experiencing forms of inappropriate behavior that was unwittingly molding who we were. And so on a certain level, what I was trying to articulate there, again, it kind of goes back to where we started this conversation, which is that, you know, I think also one of the things, I don't remember if you read that, but, you know, Griffin says, like, I make no apologies. And the reason he makes no apologies is that, you know, he doesn't want to start judging his childhood self for his own miseducation. What he cares about, again, going back to this idea of movement, is what he can say he learned now about that time. And I think we all have to do that. I mean, I think that we all have to do that. You know, Griffin in that case is talking about his wrestling coach who was horribly abusive. And I think what we all have to do is figure out ways, not just to forgive ourselves for the former selves that we were, but to use that knowledge to just become better. Because I'll end and say this, look, I mean, like in all of my work, in Mr. Peanut, my first novel, in my stories, Ladies and Gentlemen, and certainly in Play World, one of the themes I'm always obsessed with is our individual's capacity to change. And I think at one point, Griffin's therapist says something like, if life is cyclical, lengthen your diameter. You know what I mean? And so it's like, you know, maybe we do keep repeating certain things, but can we at least like repeat them less often? So that's my reaction to that piece. That's a big, I think, message of the novel.
Another one I marked was, I was taught the indelible lesson that to arrive at love, I must suffer through someone else's idea of it.
Oh, that's such a seminal, important passage in the book, because again, that's Griffin Future reflecting on his miseducation by this older woman with whom he has an inappropriate relationship, Naomi Shaw. And again, really, I shouldn't just single out his wrestling coach, because in some ways it's many of the adults in the novel, even though all of the adults, no matter how they treat him, show that they're not, you know, nobody's pure evil in the novel, but they are his, all of those adults are his family of origin, as it were. And he learns, he comes to realize that he learns, for instance, that in the case with this young woman, Amanda, who he falls in love with, that he's really, he's perhaps more attracted to the chase than he is to intimacy, right? And where has he learned that? He may have learned that from his mother with regard to her relationship with his father. And that's another form of miseducation that he's going to have to unlearn. Beyond the frame of the novel, right? Beyond the frame of the novel. Because we're constantly in life oscillating between our hopes, the things we do, and then the ways in which we correct or don't correct those mistakes.
Last week, we lost former President Carter, and his era of presidency has been top of mind. The book takes place in part during his presidency, during the Iranian hostage crisis. Part two of the book begins with the transition to the Reagan administration. What was it like for you reflecting on this era? And has that experience changed in the week since Carter's passing?
Well, gosh, I will say that it was some seriously spooky action that Carter died right when this novel was coming out, where Carter, as a sort of runway to our first actor, entertainer, president, Ronald Reagan, the Screen Actors Guild union president, when here we are with the departure of Joe Biden, you know, another one-term president giving on to another entertainer president, right? It's kind of wild. But you know what I was really trying to get at there was how, you know, the dawn of the Reagan era really had two messages. One was, you know, government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem, right? And another thing about the Reagan era that, you know, I'm not bringing news when I talk about this is there was very much like the get mine now ethos of the Reagan era. I situate the novel there because, again, I had these parents who were kind of like, it was like deregulated parenting. So in the novel, parents and how they parented Gen X kids kind of stands in for the political sphere. Like it's like smaller government when it comes to parenting. And I'm trying to look at the consequences of that because, you know, I mean, you know, one of the major pieces of legislation that Reagan passed, I'm not taking a political stand about this, it's just a fact, was the Kemp-Roth Tax Relief Act, one of the biggest tax cuts in history. And that was really when, in terms of tax policy, the cat was let out of the bag. And, you know, during the Reagan administration, we went from, you know, a $900 billion debt to a $2.1 trillion debt, right? And here we are in, again, like a low tax break political discourse. And we have, you know, what, a $36 trillion debt? And the crazy thing is, like, that's when it started. And so, you know, again, just like Griffin is looking back on the things that happened and is trying to understand them and think about the long tail of and the consequences of some of these things, you know, there's a long tail, and I don't even know if I want to say so much consequences to some of the things that were happening politically back then, but they are certainly things that we have to deal with. Because if we, for instance, want to get debt under control in this country, it's not something that one administration is going to have to deal with. It's something that multiple administrations over probably like 30 years will have to deal with. And again, guess what? That's not me being a lefty or a righty or a Democrat or Republican. That's me just pointing out that, like, that's life. Like, we spend life dealing with the consequences of previous actions. So that's part of the political dimension and the division you see in the book into two parts.
We are the same age. Did you recall, like, what was happening with these administrations, you know, with the same clarity that Griffin demonstrates in the book? Or did, please tell me that this was research, because I don't remember.
I have vivid memories of, for instance, certain things like the failure of Operation Eagle Claw when the Carter administration tried to rescue the hostages and all those soldiers died in the desert, right? But it's so interesting because the way in which I remember it by a combination of like adults complaining about Carter's ineptitude and also like newspaper articles with drawings and pictures of the, you know, the wreckage sites of these things and maps of like what the plan was. And I have very, very vivid memories of, you know, for instance, like Reagan's attempted assassination, because that was one of the first events I remember being covered on television, kind of like television is covered today, where you see the event on, this is a scene in Playworld, and you and Griffin and his friends watch the repetition over and over and over, and the over analysis of Reagan being shot and hurried off to the hospital in real time, and the misinformation that was happening in real time, right? It was like a harbinger of round the clock coverage, right? So, but no, there was a lot of research that I did. I, you know, I read, even though, for instance, as a child actor, I did do a TV show at 8H Studios 30 Rock and was there when the original Saturday Night Live cast was there. You know, I read like the oral history of Saturday Night Live. And even though, you know, I took some history, you know, in school, I went and read like The Age of Reagan and, you know, Rawhide Down about the Reagan assassination. And I read about people like Mark David Chapman and John Hinckley Jr. And I read even like David Stockman's The Triumph of Politics. So, no, I mean, there was a lot of research that went into these things. And so, you know, our memory is a funny collage of impressions and things. And then, when you go back and do the research, you're like, oh, that again, it's like the book. It's like, oh, that's what was going on.
I mentioned earlier that this is a 500-page book, and I couldn't imagine anything being edited out of it. Can you talk about your writing process? Did it start as a 1,000-page book? Do you edit as you write? How does your writing become so tight?
Oh my gosh. Well, I could talk about the process of this for an hour, but let me do it this way and say this. The first version of Playworld that I turned in about 2 years ago was 224,000 words, okay? So we ended up cutting about 40,000 words from this. And I definitely consider myself to be somebody who, in his process, you know, kind of throws the kitchen sink at what I'm doing. And then I am somebody who would rather pare down than build up, okay? So two editors worked on this book primarily. I mean, I had lots of really amazing writers who are friends of mine give me notes, et cetera, et cetera. But two editors, you know, looked at this, and my editor Kanaf, Todd Portnowitz, who is also Jhumpa Lahiri's translator and editor, he did a first edit where he gave me chapter by chapter suggestions for major cuts. And we did that. And then after I made those major cuts, then he did what's called a line edit. I'm so flattered, and I cannot tell you how much you have made my day by saying you couldn't imagine anything being taken out of the book. Because I knew while I was writing, I was like, oh gosh, you know, like this is going to be a really long book. Okay, well, damn the torpedoes, whatever. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, I was like, okay, well, now when we get to the editing process, we've got to really chisel this down to the point where these chapters have either the highest degree of propulsion or refinement, or even in their longueurs, like even in their periods where they're maybe not moving as quickly, you, the reader, have bought in so completely to the world that Griffin is creating, because world building is such a part of the book. Like, you have to accept that he's going to like really dwell on things, that has the same precision. So you get later why you were given all of this information. You know, I mean, I just think it's the responsibility of the novelist. I've read lots of the great long books, like the Moby Dicks and, you know, all the King's Men. And there are parts where you might be like, maybe that could have, you know, been taken out or something. I also don't believe that. Right. But I really did feel like it was important to feel like in the novel's length, there was at least a really clear idea of why you were spending that extra amount of time you were. So, but thank you. I felt like this was the version where you could see the novel's abs. You know, I was like, that was part of the editing process. Like, we got to see the novel's abs. The novel cut weight. The novel had to cut weight, like Griffin had to cut weight during his wrestling, his horrible wrestling weight loss session. The novel had to put on a rubber suit.
So I both read the book and listened to the audio simultaneously, and you narrate this 22-hour audiobook. Can you talk about that experience? I mean, I know you have acting experience and the voices were just, you know, on point, but talk to me about that experience of narrating your own audiobook.
So I will just say this, because there are lots of readers out there who are passionate about audiobooks, and I have a commute when I drive, and so I listen to them all the time. And even though I had done things like this as a child actor, and certainly watched my father do this when he was doing voiceover work, and doing audiobook work himself, I just have to say, like, man, it's a fascinating process. It was really fun. It was really grueling. And what is so fascinating is you have a director and you have an engineer, and they're reading the book along with you as you're reading. And you make countless mistakes. Like, the behind the scenes stuff about audiobooks for our listeners is this, like, you spend 6 hours a day in the recording studio, you break for lunch, but you're trying to capture 2 good hours per day, okay? And so while there's just the sheer labor of getting those 2 hours of seamless reading, and as you and I were joking before the recording, like, you know, moments where you mispronounce words that you've been mispronouncing all your life, right? There's also the director who's giving you coaching about where to really put pressure on certain scenes, about really ending certain chapters with a bang. Here's something I'll share that I think people will find fascinating. I do certain voices in the audiobook, but I don't feel like I overdo it. But one of the most interesting pieces of direction the director gave me was, and he was so great. He said, when you're doing the voice of someone else, I want you to worry less about like mimicry or ventriloquism. And I just want you to think of the character in your head, and that'll change your voice. And so that's what I did. And it was an incredible piece of direction because that's kind of what happened. It was, I don't recommend it to anyone, and I recommend it to everyone. You know what I mean? It was such a privilege as an author, because I know some authors would go crazy listening themselves for that long, but it was my first chance to hear the book in its entirety, like to get as close as I could. You can't ever do that as an author, but to get as close as I could to experiencing it from a reader's side. And gosh, I hope listeners don't judge me, but it moved me and it really cracked me up. And I've never had that experience with my other books. So it was kind of thrilling. And it made me think a lot about, my dad's still alive, but it just made me think a lot about the work my dad did as a voiceover performer. And I hope it makes him proud.
We have talked about a lot. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked?
Gosh, no, I feel like you just did an incredible job of covering everything.
Was an incredible book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I really do.
The book is Play World, Adam Ross. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Adam Ross, author of the book Play World, which was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.